Welcome to the deep dive, learner. Usually when we talk about the laws of physics, we expect absolute stability, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism. You drop a stone, it falls. You boil water, it turns to steam.
Right. It's completely predictable.
Exactly.
Right.
We just go through our lives with this underlying assumption that the universe has this hard-coded, unchangeable operating system, and we just live inside it. It's predictable, and honestly, we take that predictability entirely for granted.
Well, yeah, because it is a profoundly comforting baseline. We rely on the physical world behaving exactly the way it did yesterday.
Right.
I mean, if the rules of physics changed every Tuesday, society just wouldn't be able to function at all. We build our entire understanding of reality on the premise that the foundation is, you know, solid rock.
But then, and this is where it gets fun, you step into the world of high fantasy and collaborative world building.
Yeah.
And suddenly you realize, oh, wait, that operating system isn't locked down at all.
No, not even a little bit.
It is entirely open source. The rules of reality, the mechanics of magic, and even like the nature of existence itself are constantly shifting. They're being rewritten in real time.
Which is exactly what we're looking at today.
Yes. Today, we are taking a deep dive into an incredibly rich narrative transcript that serves as an absolute masterclass in tactical problem solving and philosophical world building.
It really is.
We're going to explore a universe where you might have to fight like a giant, heavily armored man scorpion 1 minute.
Terrifying, by the way.
Truly terrifying. And then grapple with the horrifying realization that your entire reality might just be someone else's passing dream the next.
Which makes it a genuinely fascinating space to analyze. Because the characters we are following here, they aren't just blindly fighting monsters with swords.
Right.
They are actively, and sometimes really painfully, testing the boundaries of their universe.
Yeah, they're like scientists.
Exactly. They are acting as scientists in a volatile environment, trying to figure out the exact mechanics of how magic works, what the hard physical limitations of their own bodies are, and ultimately trying to discover who exactly is writing the rules of their world.
So to see how they navigate that, we need to start in a place where the physical world is incredibly harsh, like completely unforgiving.
Galanann.
Yes, the dried up, parched wasteland of Galanann. Just imagine a brutal dust bowl. The sun is blindingly bright but strangely cold. The ground is cracked open, and we have three travelers riding right through the middle of it.
And it's not a happy group.
Not at all. There's Tom Thomas, who is a Lord Explorer of the Fae. There's Radial, a young woman traveling with him, and a young knight named Simon. And the environment isn't the only thing that's harsh here.
The tension is awful.
The emotional tension is suffocating. Rachel has just realized that Thomas fundamentally deceived her about Simon's true origins. She literally tells Thomas she feels deceived in absolutely everything.
Yeah, it's a quiet moment, but it shows just how heavy the weight of secrets and lies is dragging on this group.
It really does.
And that deep emotional vulnerability, that interpersonal fracture, is immediately violently interrupted by a very physical, lethal threat.
The ambush.
Right. They are ambushed in the wasteland by this faction known as the Water Mages. So the mages ride in on these gray horses wearing heavy black robes, and they demand a powerful artifact that Thomas's group is carrying.
Which they obviously aren't going to just hand over.
Exactly. And when Thomas and Rachel refuse, the mages don't just charge in with physical weapons. They hang back, begin a synchronized chant, and summon these massive, keening dust devils that completely surround the travelers.
Basically blocking any physical escape or counterattack.
Right. And Simon, being a knight, reacts the only way he knows how.
He hits it.
He draws his sword and tries to strike one of the dust devils.
This is just, I mean, it's wind.
Yeah. His sword just passes harmlessly right through the swirling wind. The dust devil doesn't even flinch before it violently swats him right off his horse.
Oh, man. And it is looking incredibly grim until the cavalry quite literally arrives over the horizon.
The Lady Redmane.
Agatha. She's a fierce warrior, also known as Lady Redmane. And she isn't just riding a regular horse. She's mounted on a hern, a massive, highly intelligent white stallion.
And learner, when they say intelligent, they mean a hern actually communicates telepathically with the characters.
Yeah, he is the Lord of Horses. It's so cool. Agatha charges directly into the fray. And with a brilliantly timed, devastating strike of her heavy iron lance, she takes down one of the apprentice mages. Abnegai, I think his name was.
Yeah, Abnegai.
And the moment the mage falls, his concentration is broken and his dust devil instantly collapses.
That precise moment highlights something crucial about the mechanics of this world. Magic here isn't an omnipotent, unbeatable force that just exists once it's cast.
Right?
It requires active, continuous focus. It requires physical chanting, line of sight, and time. If you break the caster's concentration, you break the spell. It grounds the magic system in very practical, physical vulnerabilities.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the way magic is utilized here is so deeply tactical.
It really is.
It is not just waving a wand and yelling a spell to solve a problem. It is entirely about physics and elemental interactions.
Yeah, like Rachel in the water skin.
Exactly. While they are surrounded by these raging dust devils, Thomas realizes the wind constructs are absorbing the dry earth to maintain their physical form. So instead of trying to hack at the wind with a sword like Simon did, Thomas yells at Rachel to use her water skin.
And she just lobs the water at it.
She unplugs it and throws a solid arc of water directly into the center of the dust devil, blocking her path. The moment the water hits the dry, swirling earth, the entire construct shimmers like liquid lightning, violently explodes, and just vanishes.
It's a brilliant tactical pivot. I mean, they stop treating the magic like a monster to be slain and start treating it like an environmental hazard to be neutralized.
Exactly. And I want you to think about this in terms of your own daily problem solving, Larner. How often do we try to hit a dust devil with a sword?
Oh, all the time.
Right. Meaning, how often do we use the completely wrong tool for a problem just because it's the tool we happen to have in our hand?
Mm.
Simon's instinct was to strike it. But that's like fighting a grease fire in your kitchen with water.
Which is a terrible idea.
A terrible idea. If you throw water on a grease fire, you don't extinguish it. You just cause a massive explosion and spread the flames. You have to understand the specific chemical makeup of your obstacle before you try to overcome it. In this wasteland, knowing your elemental matchups isn't just clever. It is a literal matter of life and death.
But you know, knowing those external elemental rules isn't always enough to save you. Because while the physical battles are dictated by these strict environmental laws, the characters are simultaneously forced to test their own biological limitations against the universe.
Oh yeah, this part is intense.
Thomas understands the rules of magic perfectly, but his own biology presents a massive hurdle.
Which brings us to a really intense, quiet scene shortly after the ambush. The battle is over. They've captured one of the mages named Emilio, and they are preparing to head into this dangerous ruined chapel.
Right.
Now, Thomas, as we mentioned, is of the Fae. And in this universe, the Fae have a severe aversion to iron. But Thomas knows he might need to use Agatha's iron sword if they get trapped inside. He decides he has to try and build a physical tolerance to it.
Which is brave, but foolish.
Very. He asks Agatha to hand him her sword, but first, she wraps the hilt in a thick silk handkerchief to act as a buffer. Thomas reaches out, closes his eyes, and grabs the wrapped hilt.
Huh.
Almost instantly, his entire arm begins to shake violently.
Just from touching it through the silk.
Yeah. He manages to hold it for just a few agonizing seconds before he drops it to the dirt, clutching his chest. When Agatha peels his glove back to check on him, the flesh on his palm is bright red, swollen, and violently burned.
What's fascinating here is how the source material treats iron. I mean, in traditional fantasy settings, iron is just a strong metal used for forging weapons.
Right, it's just gear.
Exactly. But here, it acts as a fundamental anti-fey element. It is an undeniable law of nature. Thomas is a powerful lord explorer, a seasoned warrior who just stared down lethal magic, but he absolutely cannot bypass this elemental rule through sheer willpower. The iron fundamentally rejects his existence.
So what does this all mean? I need to push back on this a little. If iron is just a metal, just a mundane material pulled from the earth, why does it specifically burn the Fae? Is it like a chemical reaction? Because if magic is just physics in this world, a simple allergy doesn't really feel like it fits the severity of what's happening to his hand.
That's exactly the right question to ask. It's not a histamine response or a simple allergy. It is an existential incompatibility.
Okay, existential.
Yeah, the Fae are beings composed of magic and myth. Iron represents the absolute most mundane, grounded, immutable element of the physical world. It anchors reality. So when a Fae touches iron, it's not a chemical burn. It is the physical world aggressively neutralizing their magical nature.
That makes so much sense. I look at this universe like a complex piece of software. If the Fae are the magical elements of the code, like the dynamic, shifting scripts, then iron represents the cold, immovable hardware limitations of the mundane world.
Ooh, I like that.
Right, it's like a hard-coded computer bug or a virus hitting a firewall.
Uh-huh.
When Thomas touches the iron, the mundane hardware is violently rejecting his magical software. The universe is literally flashing an error message saying, you do not compute with this material.
That hardware limitation is a perfect analogy. But if iron is the hardware limitation of their world, what happens when the characters discover that the software of their reality itself is completely vulnerable?
Oh man, the palace scene.
Yes, because while Thomas is confronting his physical limits in the desert, another character is uncovering a metaphysical vulnerability miles away in a snowy palace garden.
We have to talk about Alice. She's a little girl, accompanied by her dog Kuon, but she is acting as a covert spy in the Palace of All Seasons.
A very effective spy.
Very. She's summoned to a clandestine meeting in a dark, freezing garden by a powerful figure named the Sorceress Niue. They are discussing a terrifying political landscape. The houses of summer and winter are rallying together to crown a man named Lord April.
But Alice has been watching him?
Yes, she has been observing him closely, and she suspects Lord April is actually an imposter. She believes he is an ancient, world-ending evil known as the Destroyer, or the Year's End, hiding in plain sight.
And Niue is, understandably, horrified. If the Destroyer takes the throne, it's the end of their world. So to help Alice prove her theory, Niue hands her a magical artifact called the Opticon.
The lens, right.
Yeah, it's a lens specifically designed to capture a person's true underlying image, piercing through any glamour or illusion. Niue also points out a critical behavioral weakness in their enemy.
Oh, this is so clever.
It is. The Destroyer would never willingly step onto holy ground unless that ground was defiled first. This gives Alice a tactical, environmental way to trap him by forcing a meeting in the royal chapel.
It's incredible palace intrigue. But then, the conversation shifts from political espionage to something profoundly existential. Alice recites a prophecy to Niue.
The prophecy about the dreams.
Right. She says, in the lands beyond where fresh dreams are born, rules can be changed by those with the mind to. Alice is with the grand puzzle together. She realizes that the mundane mortal world, the place they call Ennington, is actually the land where dreams are born.
Which means?
That makes their own entire universe, Mirari, the dream world. The characters are coming to the staggering, terrifying realization that their universe is birthed directly from the imaginations of mortal people.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the characters are waking up to the fact that their reality is tethered to the passing thoughts of people in another dimension.
It's wild to think about.
It really is. The narrative confirms this when Thomas talks about a mortal man named Ryan Jordan, who was known in Mirari as King Riordan. Ryan apparently made a casual, offhand comment before leaving the mortal world that a single year was long enough for any king to rule.
Just a passing thought.
Just idle musing. And it literally manifested as the immutable rule of a year in the world of Mirari.
Imagine that, learner. Imagine if a stray thought you had at breakfast, like a passing comment about how Monday shouldn't exist, suddenly became the literal law of gravity for an entire universe.
It's horrifying.
They are trapped by the idle musings of mortals.
Hmm.
But Alice's prophecy reveals the flip side of that horror. If the rules are just born from dreams, it means the rules aren't actually permanent. They can be hacked, bent, or broken by anyone who understands the code.
Exactly. And that profound realization that you can hack the system if you understand the source code is exactly the mindset Thomas, Agatha, and Simon have to employ back at the Galanan Chapel.
Right, back in the desert.
Yeah. They finally reach the ruins to break the drought, cursing the land, but they are blocked by the chapel's guardian, and this creature is pure nightmare fuel.
Oh my gosh, the Viglari.
Yes. It is a giant, heavily armored chitinous creature. It's like a man's torso grafted onto a massive scorpion's body. It holds a huge lance in one hand and has a crushing lobster claw for the other.
And remember the hardware rule we established earlier. Thomas cannot touch iron. His physical options against a heavily armored, lance-wielding scorpion centaur are severely limited.
He tries to hit it with his fey sword, right?
He does. He actually tries to use his fey sword, but it just sparks harmlessly off the creature's thick shell. He has to completely rely on Agatha and the stallion Ahern. Agatha braces her heavy iron lance. Ahern holds his ground with perfect discipline. And when the Viglari charges, they use the creature's own momentum against it.
A classic braced charge.
Yeah, the iron pierces its chest and the monster literally shrivels up into a cloud of poison smoke. It's a brutal, brilliant use of the exact right tool for the job.
And once the Guardian is dead, they enter the Dark Chapel and find the mechanism causing the drought. There is an altar with an eternal flame burning on it, seemingly without any fuel source. Lying next to it are three pieces of a broken shepherd's staff.
The curse focus.
Right. The water mages place the flame there to represent the absolute absence of water, fundamentally stopping the spring from flowing.
So Thomas initially tries to piece the wooden staff back together, but it won't hold. He tries to burn the wood in the flame, but it just chars. So he steps back, stops trying to force a physical solution, and goes back to elemental logic.
The software hack.
Exactly. He asks for a water skin, holds it high above the eternal flame, and lets a single tiny drop of water fall. That one drop extinguishes the massive magical flame instantly.
So elegant.
The room goes dark, and the ghost of an old priest, Father Kilby, manifests. The ghost explains that the broken staff was a holy artifact that acted as the focus to bring water from the rocks. Without a powerful holy relic to replace it, the land is doomed to remain a desert, even with a curse lifted.
Which sets up a seemingly impossible systems failure. I mean, they deleted the malware, the curse, but the local ecosystem's operating system is still fundamentally broken because the hardware that sustained it is shattered.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Simon steps forward. He pulls a simple white cloth-covered box from his backpack. He opens it, and brilliant warm daylight pours out, illuminating the entire dusty, ruined chapel.
I love this part.
He reaches in, pulls out a simple chalice, and places it squarely on the altar. It is the Holy Grail. Lerner, he had been entrusted with this by a powerful figure named Pelles, who acts as a guardian of ancient relics.
And the moment the grail touches the altar, the earth itself begins to violently shake. Outside, the dried-up spring erupts. A massive, roaring surge of water blasts out of the rocks, filling the reservoir and rushing down the dry riverbeds.
It's instant, right?
Yeah, where the spray lands, lush green grass instantly grows, and tiny blue flowers bloom completely out of season. A rainbow even forms over the waste.
Is an incredible cinematic moment. But I want to pause here because we have to ask, why does a real-world Christian mythic artifact work to fix a pagan fantasy ecosystem?
Because of the dreams.
Exactly. It's not just a cool narrative crossover. Think back to what Alice discovered. Merari is a world birthed entirely from human dreams. Therefore, the most powerful, enduring human myths like the Holy Grail carry the heaviest, most undeniable source code in this universe.
That makes total sense.
Introducing the Grail isn't just a magic trick. It's like dropping a master admin password into a broken software program. It carries so much mythological weight from the mortal world that it completely overrides and reboots the broken code of the wasteland.
That is the perfect way to contextualize it. It is a metaphysical override, and it is a massive victory for the heroes. They successfully healed the land. However, miraculously fixing an ecosystem overnight has immediate, deeply chaotic socioeconomic consequences.
Oh yeah, huge fallout.
You cannot simply upend a total monopoly on a vital resource without massive societal fallout.
Which we see the absolute second they return to the town of Karasidi with their captive mage Emilio. The townspeople are in full riot mode. They're gathered outside the monastery of the Water Mages, demanding their gold back.
Because they've been gouged for months.
Right. These mages have been charging extortionate, ruinous prices for water, while the drought they created was suffocating the town. The crowd is furious and they want blood.
And Thomas tries to step in and calm the crowd, promising a lawful justice. But the leader of the Water Mages, Master Faust, throws open the monastery doors. He is utterly arrogant.
The worst kind of villain.
Truly. He looks out at the angry mob and threatens to unleash a catastrophic ritual from the catacombs below. If he isn't allowed to leave peacefully with all his extorted gold and a magical cauldron they possess, he promises to curse the entire town with eternal dehydration.
This is a horrific threat.
He claims they will simply dry up from the inside out, never able to quench their thirst, even if they plunge themselves into the newly restored river.
So Faust is cornered, but he has the entire town held hostage with this threat. Emilio, the captive mage, is terrified of Faust and points Agatha toward a dry well in the courtyard that leads directly down into the subterranean catacombs.
And Agatha just goes for it.
She doesn't have time to plan a tactical assault. She decides they just need a massive distraction to stop the ritual before it starts. She pulls a glowing red potion out of her pack, another item she received from the relic guardian Pelles. And she literally just drops it down the dark shaft of the dry well.
She doesn't even know exactly what it will do. She just imagines a fiery serpent, hoping the potion will manifest something that likes dark, enclosed tunnels. and has a taste for arrogant mages.
And boy, does it ever work. There's a massive, echoing whoosh of flame shooting up out of the well. A literal fire dragon, made entirely of roaring flames with dark burning coals for eyes, erupts into the underground ritual chamber.
A literal dragon.
It glides directly over the mages, incinerating one of them into ash instantly. The sheer, overwhelming terror of a fire dragon appearing in a sealed room causes the remaining mages to faint dead away. Agatha literally summoned a fire dragon down a well to break up a hostage situation.
It is chaotic, it is deeply improvisational, and it is an incredible example of hacking the magic system on the fly. It is undeniably effective, but this raises an important question. A question about the nature of justice versus vengeance.
Yeah, that's a tough one here.
The mages were exceptionally cruel. I mean, we learned from the townspeople that the mages even cursed a young woman named Hannah with a straw dehydration doll, causing her immense suffering simply because she gave a cup of water to a beggar.
Unbelievable.
So the townspeople are entirely justified in wanting them executed. And Agatha's dragon certainly didn't show any mercy to the mage it incinerated. But Thomas steps in and insists on capturing Faust alive.
Which the town is not happy about.
No, but he argues that letting the mob tear them apart is just petty vengeance. More importantly, from a tactical standpoint, they need Faust alive for interrogation because of his potential ties to the true enemy, the Destroyer.
Which proves to be exactly the right call. When Thomas chases Faust into a private side study, he finds the master mage staring longingly at an old portrait. The painting shows a blonde man reaching for a heart-shaped ruby, surrounded by alchemical equipment.
Lord Eowyn.
Thomas immediately recognizes the man in the painting as Lord Eowyn, who is also known as John Harcourt for the mortal world of Aenetin. Faust is practically weeping, pleading with the painting, begging not to be abandoned by his master.
It's pathetic, honestly.
It reveals just how deep and manipulative the Destroyer's reach truly is. He promises immense power to men like Faust, uses them to fund his operations and oppress the local people, and then completely discards them the second they fail.
It perfectly illustrates the true scale of the stakes. The heroes aren't just fighting rogue monsters in the desert or greedy mages in a town. They are unraveling a massive, multidimensional conspiracy orchestrated by a being who intimately understands how to manipulate the very fabric and source code of their reality.
It really is an incredible journey. For you listening, learner, we've covered a massive amount of ground today. We watched heroes fight keening dust devils with water skins and take down terrifying man scorpions with iron lances.
We saw a lot of action today.
We did. But more importantly, we watched them actively grapple with the literal underlying rules of their reality. Whether it is the physical, burning hardware rejection of iron against fey flesh, or the mind-bending software realization that their entire universe is birthed from the passing dreams of a mortal world, the true battle here is always against the boundaries of existence itself.
They are constantly searching for the workaround. They refuse to accept the system as it is presented to them. They use an elemental opticon to reveal the hidden truth. They use a single drop of water to short-circuit a massive magical flame. And they drop a mythological admin password onto a broken altar to reboot an entire ecosystem.
And that is exactly what I want you to reflect on as you go about your day. How often do you feel completely bound by the rules of your own industry, your workplace, or your life?
Probably a lot.
Right. Are those rules actual immutable laws of physics? Or are they just the rule of a year, something someone made up a long time ago in a passing thought that everyone just blindly accepted as law? How can adopting the mindset of these characters, looking for the metaphysical workaround, understanding the elemental matchups of your problems, change your perspective on the obstacle standing in your way? Where is your opticon?
It's a powerful way to reframe your daily challenges. And I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to mull over. We talked at the very beginning about our universe operating like a hard-coded physics engine.
Yeah.
But if the world of Mirari is truly shaped by the dreams, the offhand comments, and the passing thoughts of the people in the mundane world, then what universes are we accidentally creating right now? And what responsibilities do we, as the dreamers, have to the worlds and the realities we might be constructing in our own minds every single day?
A beautiful, heavy thought. Till next time, learner, keep questioning the code.